It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Dozens of police departments across the country are inflating their numbers of successfully closed rape cases through a technical loophole. On paper, it looks like the cases are solved. In reality, they're not, and defendants walk free. Our guest investigates how widespread this problem is and what's causing it. Are you familiar with the problem of rape cases being exceptionally cleared? They're presented to the public as solved when a department is just closing the case. What do you think should be done about this problem? What reforms do you think we need to make when it comes to how police departments across the country handle sexual assault cases? Do you work in law enforcement? Do you see this happening in your community? Does your department close rape cases for a reason? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is our email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Mark Greenblatt is a senior national investigative correspondent for Scripps, D.C. He is one of the co-lead reporters of Case Cleared, How Rape Goes Unpunished in America, a joint investigation from Newsy, Reveal, and ProPublica. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
So good to be with you.
So tell us about Brian Kind. I understand that last spring, a hotel manager in Janesville saw Kind behaving inappropriately with a young girl and called the police. But as it turned out, Kind had already had a brush with the police before. What happened?
Well, more than a brush. You know, the report came in that he was really having sexual contact in a very public and inappropriate way in a hotel in Janesville. And when, they eventually arrested him when the young girl, who was underage, did cry out to police that she had had sexual contact with Mr. Kind, who's a full-grown man, more than 200 times, it eventually came out. And through the course of the investigation, they were looking into his background. They found that he had clearly a long record of being arrested by police for various different kinds of non-sexual related crimes. But where we found him as an investigative team was we picked him up long before he ever landed in Wisconsin having sex with a young girl there. We picked him up, and I should note it is alleged right now because he is pending trial. We picked him up in Baltimore County, Maryland, where police there in Baltimore County and at another neighboring agency had been investigating him for the same sort of thing, for making contact allegedly with a 12-year-old girl there, and eventually driving from Michigan all the way to Maryland in order to allegedly have sex with her there. There were hotel receipts. There were interviews with the young girl. There were email exchanges showing what appeared to be a real sexual relationship. And yet police in Baltimore County, when they received the case and really on a silver platter from a neighboring police agency, they were having a hard time making personal contact with the victim, a young girl and her family. And so after a couple of phone calls, according to police record, they decided to clear the case. And what they did here was they cleared the case in a manner that allowed the Baltimore County Police Department to look better to the public. It actually raised their clearance rate for the crime of rape. And yet what they did was they left this guy on the streets. There was no arrest. They didn't even interview him. They didn't have the case reviewed by the prosecutor. They didn't call the FBI. And they simply left him on the streets, but they chalked it up as a win in their clearances. And they did this because of this use of this loophole of sorts called exceptional clearance. And what we had discovered as a team was that almost no one has ever heard of this. There's been very little reporting done on it, very little academic research ever done on this sort of thing. Because at the end of the day, the public is simply told, hey, our police are doing a great job of clearing crimes. We're clearing X number of percentage of our rape cases or murders, rapes, and robberies. And what they're not told is sort of what makes that clearance rate up.
Well, I'm getting a little lost in cleared and closed. Let's define some terms here. The Baltimore police cleared Brian Kind's case. Cleared case implies to, I think, most people that the case was solved and whoever the perpetrator was went to court, whether they were not guilty or guilty, but at least, you know, they arrested someone and someone went to trial. So that's what I would, you know, that the average person might assume that cleared means that the case was solved. What is a cleared case? What does that phrase mean?
Well, you're not the only one getting confused, and part of that is because the Baltimore County Police Chief himself, dating back to 2013 under a different chief than sits there today, talks to the public and using those same terms, saying that our clearance rates are a measure of, quote-unquote, how many cases we solve. And what we have figured out is that that's really misleading because you can clear a case if you do make an arrest, that's true. But what the FBI has set up is this rare loophole that is supposed to allow police who know where a suspect lives, have identified him, actually have probable cause to make an arrest, want to make the arrest, but can't because of a reason outside of their control. They've allowed this loophole for not to punish them in their clearance rates to claim a case was exceptionally cleared. You're supposed to be able to do it in cases like if the suspect, for instance, that you want to arrest has died and is no longer arrestable, or if they're, you know, in prison in a foreign jail and simply not reachable. They don't want to punish the police agency and make it look like they're not doing their job in these very, very rare circumstances. And so those are the two ways you're allowed to clear a case, by this rare exceptional means or by an actual arrest.
So cleared actually just means the police department is done with it.
Police department's not only done with it, but different than a closed case or something that's sort of that they just weren't able to make progress with. Cleared means they have probable cause to make an arrest. They believe they have probable cause to make an arrest, but they can't or they don't for reasons outside of their control.
That's exceptional clearance, but just cleared case in general. The police say we cleared a case. That just means they're done with it, right? They've done their part. They've arrested somebody or they've said we can't arrest anybody, but the case is cleared. We're finished with it.
That would be correct. They are done with it.
Okay. And all right. So I'm glad we got that cleared up. No pun intended. You mentioned exceptional clearance. That's that's kind of the thing that's become quite popular, according to your research. But that's supposed to be used in very rare circumstance. How do we know how often this is used in terms of percentage of cases that you investigated?
Yeah, it does. It really is community by community. We found that in some police agencies, they use this very rarely, as intended. But really, the striking thing in this research and what we did was we had to go out to more than 100 police agencies across the country and ask for their data directly through public records requests, because it's very hard to reach. The FBI and the DOJ don't even know for the majority of police agencies when a police agency reports a crime is cleared, they don't know if it's been cleared by arrest or by exceptional means. So we had to go directly to the source, and what we found is in many cases, almost half the cases that we looked at, almost half the agencies that we received data back from, they had taken this thing that was supposed to be the exception to the rule, and really it has become the rule for the crime of rape, where they're clearing more cases exceptionally, leaving people on the streets that they allegedly have probable cause to arrest. They're doing this more often than they are actually making arrests. So we're really getting, when we're being told the overall clearance rate, which is, of course, arrests plus this loophole of exceptional clearance, we're getting really a misleading picture of how many rape cases are being solved in many, many communities across America.
Mark Greenblatt is a senior national investigative correspondent for Scripps, D.C. He will stay with us as our conversation continues. What do you think should be done about how police handle sexual assault cases? Maybe you work in law enforcement. Do you see this happening in your community? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Dozens of police departments across the country are clearing rape cases. Well, it looks like they're closed, even though investigators aren't necessarily solving the crimes. Are you familiar with the problem of sexual assault cases being exceptionally cleared? What reforms do you think we need to make when it comes to how police departments across the country handle these cases? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Mark Greenblatt is with us. He's Senior National Investigative Correspondent for Scripps, D.C. Mark, you wanted information from more than 100 police departments. 64 of them responded. 39 police jurisdictions declined your request for data. The Milwaukee Police Department was one of them. You still were able to find data on Milwaukee, though, and you report its rape clearance rate is 66%, 57% due to arrest, 9% exceptional clearance. How does Milwaukee compare to other cities you looked at?
Well, this is a very interesting part of the story. It's really impossible to tell the story accurately in Milwaukee, because what they refused to turn over was a set of statistics that shows how often they claim a case that's reported to them is quote-unquote unfounded. What that means is if they believe that they have enough evidence to prove that someone who reported a rape lied about it, reported a false report, or something that they were maybe confused about, something called a baseless crime. They can unfound a case, wipe it off their books altogether, and so we don't really ever hear about it. And Milwaukee is part of this next generation way of reporting crime statistics to the FBI, where they do disclose publicly how many cases they actually exceptionally clear. So there's some good news there with Milwaukee. But the bad news is this new system that is supposed to increase transparency for America, we've discovered, has completely ended the collection of statistics on unfounded cases. And this is something that police agencies in Chicago and Baltimore and New Orleans and St. Louis have all had real scandals over doing this too often, wiping reports of rape off their books entirely. In Milwaukee, they're refusing to give us their data. They have not turned it over. We don't know, and neither does the FBI and neither does the Department of Justice. We just don't know how many cases they are unfounding. And so we can tell you that they have a low exceptional clearance rate compared to others. That's the good news. But we don't know how many crimes are taking off the books.
Some of the departments that didn't report have high clearance rates, 98% in San Francisco, 93% in Pittsburgh. Given what you've told us so far this morning, how should we look at those numbers?
Well, I think probably with a healthy degree of skepticism. San Francisco had been hovering for many years a much, much, much lower clearance rate, and all of a sudden in a recent year they just spiked dramatically. I think more than their clearance rate rose, I think, by nearly twice as much, and they're one of the agencies that don't want to turn their data over to us, Pittsburgh as well. But I can tell you, for instance, a good teaching tool here, Austin, Texas is an area that we focused a lot of reporting on, and they reported to the public 51% clearance rate for the crime of rape. When we dug into their data, it was they were only arresting 17% of their cases. All of the rest were exceptional clearance. And it's worth noting that we also talked to a 26-year insider from the Austin Police Department who used to lead their sex crimes unit, and she told us she was ordered at one point to change the clearance codes in the city of Austin from suspended sort of dormant status to exceptionally cleared, she believed, for the purposes of trying to provide a false picture to the city and the public about how effective they were at actually solving rape cases. So this isn't just numbers and data. You know, we really have some indications that, at least in some departments, that these exceptional clearances are being used to provide a misleading picture to the public.
So what's the motivation for departments to improperly use exceptional clearance? What do they gain from doing this?
Well, you know, what we saw in Austin was we saw the police chief and leadership going before city council at budget hearings, really sort of saying, hey, we want some more money for different pet projects. And then they'd be grilled on, well, you know what, the city council would actually say, well, we really want you to solve more crimes. And they'd come back and they'd say, no, look, we're doing great, guys. We're above the national average for the crime, for clearance rates when it comes to rape and other violent crimes. So don't worry about that. let us have money for what we want. And so that's we've seen it there. But it's also just good politics, you know. I mean, if you have if you're trying to attract Amazon.com, you know, or Amazon rather, to come move to your city, you don't want to have a problem with solving rapes and other violent crimes. You want the books to look good. So there are some political motivations that are out there to try to bump up clearance rates.
But is it possible that the use of excessive use of exceptional clearance in rape cases can be at least partially explained by the reluctance of some victims to cooperate with police?
Yeah, it can be, and that is one of the allowed reasons why you're allowed to sort of, as a police agency, chalk this up as an exceptionally cleared case. But the trick here is that according to the FBI rules, there's no exception to this. No pun intended. That if a victim who initially reports to police that they were raped or that they had a sexual assault take place decides later that they just don't have it in them to move forward and take the stand and testify, still, in order to exceptionally clear the case, police still have to have enough evidence, even without the victim, to have probable cause to make an arrest. And so what this is intended to do is it's intended to encourage police to investigate more and investigate harder and see what else they could do. In the case of Brian Kind, who landed in Wisconsin after being cleared in Baltimore County, they never even interviewed the suspect. And so what experts have told us is that if they would have done that, this is a guy who eventually was found with, allegedly with child porn on his cell phone. They likely could have found it, experts say, on his phone back then, maybe found even more on his computers. And then with that evidence, even without a victim, they would have been able to move forward with a prosecution and not put the pressure of justice on the shoulders of a 13-year-old victim of sexual assault, which is what happened here. And the rub here is that why you should care about this, even if you don't live in Baltimore County, is that when people are exceptionally cleared that, where there's evidence that they are an alleged child predator or just a rapist of adults, when they're left on the streets in one city, even hundreds or thousands of miles away, they can move, as happened in this case when this guy moved to Wisconsin and allegedly struck again.
Mark Greenblatt is senior national investigative correspondent for Scripps DC. Mark, do law enforcement officials clear other crimes in the same way?
They do. They're allowed to do this. Of course, they have probable cause to make the arrest and can't do it for reasons outside of their control. But we really did see a trend with sexual assaults where it seemed to be used more often. And, it's possible that one of the reasons for this is that many sexual assaults are more challenging cases. If a prosecutor doesn't want to move forward on a case because it's, they on their end are potentially motivated by conviction rates. They look good when they have a high conviction rate, which can easily take place if you prosecute the easiest cases. You really have a system that may be strained on DAs. They're motivated to have higher conviction rates, and on the police side, they want higher clearance rates. So everybody wants to look good to the public, but the trick is you want the cases to actually lead to that you're going to claim are solved, to actually lead to arrests as often as possible.
Have we? Are there any policy changes proposed to deal with the abuse of exceptional clearance by local law enforcement?
Well, the number one thing that people can do is if your police agency locally has not joined the next generation way of reporting crime statistics to the FBI that forces them to publicly disclose how many exceptionally cleared cases they have, people can go to city council and demand that this happens. If, however, you live somewhere that's already done that, then you can, at this stage, go to your U.S. congressman and say, I also want to know how many rapes my police agency are unfounding every year. And I understand that the new FBI system does not track that anymore. We interviewed a top official with the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Statistics, who said this is a travesty and it needs to change. And this was a woman who oversees the incident, the new incident-based reporting system on the for the DOJ side, and she didn't know about this, that they had stopped collecting this information, and she's sort of taken it upon herself to try as best as she can to get somebody to listen over at the FBI or in Congress to change this, because she thinks this is really something that's threatening the viability and credibility of crime statistics in general across the board for the entire country.
So even if a local police department reports the number of exceptional clearances to the FBI, what does that actually mean? I mean, the FBI isn't doing anything about it, are they?
The FBI trusts agencies to largely report accurately, and they won't come in with a bunch of federal agents in black suits and ties to, you know, stop the agency. But the thing that really struck me is that there are some agencies that are reporting and publicly disclosing, even in this new way of reporting crime statistics, how often they exceptionally clear cases. But nobody's really asking questions about it. So, you know, what can people do? If their agency does have a high rate, they can call in to their local city council. They can go to a public meeting and demand answers and start raising questions for the first time. This is something that nobody's really raised questions about. And people do need to take action and let their elected leaders know that they care about transparency. Because at the end of the day, this matters for how safe the cities that they live in really are.
Mark Greenblatt, thanks for joining us this morning.
You bet.
Mark Greenblatt is a senior national investigative correspondent for Scripps DC. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. When a high school student athlete takes a hard hit, an athletic trainer may be the first on the scene to assist and diagnose any issues or injuries. Depending on the school, access to trainers can be uneven. That can be problematic, according to a new study, especially if an athlete has taken a hard hit to the head. Our guest researcher looks at the relationship between access to athletic trainers at Wisconsin's high schools and how concussions are diagnosed. Are you an athlete who's been diagnosed with a concussion? If so, did an athletic trainer help you through the process? Or maybe you are an athletic trainer. Tell us about your experiences working with student athletes. What do you think can be done to make these athletes safer? And what questions do you have about identifying concussions? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tim McGuine is senior scientist and a sports medicine researcher at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He is the principal investigator on a new study that looks at the relationship between the availability of athletic trainers and concussions at Wisconsin high schools. Tim, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you for having me on.
First of all, give us a little bit of background about this study and what specifically you were looking for.
Well, our purpose was to look at how athletic trainers are utilized in interscholastic settings and across the state of Wisconsin. So our goal was to pick a single pathology, a single injury, and study that in terms of how it's reported, how it's managed in these different school settings. And we know from our previous work that a lot of factors play into the availability of athletic trainers. We know that counties with lower median household incomes or schools with higher levels of free and reduced lunch have lower access. And we tried to see what exactly that role that played then in terms of how, A, concussions were identified, and then, B, how they were managed in that setting. So that was the premise for this particular study.
What does the job of an athletic trainer entail? What do they do?
Well, it's really varied. You know, in the interscholastic setting, the high school setting, it can be anything from event pre-season physical awareness, making sure these kids are prepared to play, making sure you have an injury history taken. And during the seasons, it can be making available to recognize injuries that they occur. It can be providing emergency medical services as needed at different sport venues. And once an injury occurs, it can be documenting where the appropriate referral goes. Does they have to go to an emergency room? Can they be managed at the school itself? Can they be sent to their primary care provider? And once that injury then has been diagnosed and it's been identified, what's the rehabilitation parameters that need to be taken? And so those athletic trainers are involved in all of those phases in many of these high school settings.
And how many, well, there are over 500 high schools in Wisconsin. How many of, do we know how many of them actually have an athletic trainer on staff?
Well, you know, and that's a fluctuating number from year to year. And we're looking at the schools that just offer athletic programs, so then we're really down around the 400 school range. And really, in Wisconsin, it's pretty good. Compared to other states, it's much better. Access to athletic trainers, it's much better in terms of, depending on which year you studied, 95-plus percent of the schools have access to an athletic trainer at some time during their high school year, whether it might be just during the football season. But at many of the schools, about a third of them have somebody on-site available every day in the afternoon and most athletic events at home.
And where do these athletic trainers come from? I mean, is this their full-time job?
Yeah, and most of them are employed through clinics and hospitals. So you may have a hospital or clinic provider in the area that employs the athletic trainer. Maybe in the morning they work with orthopedic patients or sports patients or in a rehab setting. Then in the afternoon they are contracted to go to the high school, work the high school the rest of their day. So, and they're all prepared. They all have a minimum of a bachelor's degree. Most have a master's degree. They have to pass a national certification exam and complete state licensure requirements to go ahead and work in this setting.
Tim McGuine is senior scientist and a sports medicine researcher at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about the availability of athletic trainers for high school athletic programs in the state of Wisconsin and how that might actually have an impact on the health of our student athletes. Tim, do some schools have less access to a trainer simply because of money, or are there other reasons?
Well, in part it's money. What we found in our study was we couldn't identify any schools that paid for the athletic trainer services on their own. They usually had it subsidized either 50% to 100% by a local medical provider. So, you know, that plays a role in this as well. And so you see in these counties and these school areas where you have multiple medical providers, they're more likely to have access to athletic trainers than a rural or urban setting where you don't have as many medical providers there on site and available to get these athletic trainers out in the schools. The schools themselves rarely pay for them on their own.
Well, and quite a few school districts in Wisconsin are in rural areas, and so that's really what you're saying is that's where the biggest part of this problem is?
Yeah, it is, but we also found, you know, in inner city Milwaukee, we found the same thing. So, you know, you can look at, say, in northern Wisconsin, Price County is similar to urban Milwaukee County in terms of athletic trainer availability. We see a limited availability in all those in both of those situations, so it's not just a rural situation. It's almost a medically underserved situation. It's a public health situation. We find it identical to other issues with public health access.
So what did you find about schools that have lots of accessibility to trainers?
So we found, like, in the schools with a high number of athletic trainers or a good relationship or a good ratio of athletic trainers availability to the number of athletes, where we see that and they're able to really manage it, we see they're much more likely to recognize concussions. If a concussion is suspected, they're more likely to see that within minutes or less than an hour, whereas in a low-access school, it can be several days. We know that the overall rate in the lower-access schools is much lower than what we would expect from a nationwide survey. So it's less than half of what's reported nationwide. So we think we have a number of concussions that are not identified in those situations. And more importantly, in the high-access schools, we see that once the concussion's occurred, there's more consensus-based follow-up in terms of guidelines that need to be done. So we want to, A, contact a physician, B, contact the parents. We want to contact the coaches to make sure they're aware of it. If academic modifications need to be made, we want to go ahead and do those things. We want to have a structured return-to-play protocol, so we want to monitor the athlete to see how long they had the symptoms. And once the symptoms are resolved, then we don't want to just let them go back to sports. We want them to go back to sports in a structured manner where we rehabilitate and get them to where they're safely able to go. And ultimately, we're finding in the schools with high access to athletic trainers, that time frame is longer. They're keeping the kids out longer in those situations, which is probably a better thing, because we don't want to get these kids back on the field in 6 or 7 days. We're seeing that the kids that are with athletic trainers, they're extending that out, and we're less likely then to have a repeat concussion or long-term effects from concussion. So we're seeing all those effects. They're recognizing more, and they're treating them more appropriately in those high-access schools.
And then on the flip side, the schools that have much less access to trainers, concussions aren't being diagnosed as quickly, and there are problems there?
Right. We're seeing that, again, there's a lag time. So, for example, if you're at a school in a rural setting 1 hour a week and a concussion takes place on a Tuesday night soccer game, you may not be there at the school to really examine or work with that kid till a Friday, 3 days later, as opposed to being on the sideline right there.
Don't coaches get some training about concussion protocols, though?
They do. And you know, the WIA has been very proactive with encouraging coaches, officials, anybody suspected of a concussion is told to get that person off the athletic field immediately. And then the rules state that they have to be examined by a licensed medical provider before they can go back on the field. And, yeah, we know that. But, again, coaches are coaches, teachers are teachers. Not everybody has that same level of care or same level of training to recognize these things.
And is there pressure at some smaller schools where there are fewer players to get somebody back on the field quicker?
I haven't seen that. As I said, I've been working with in the high schools for 30 years in the state of Wisconsin. I can count the number of times on one hand and thousands of injuries where I've had a coach or parent ask that their athlete be returned before they were able to be. Mm-hmm. So that really doesn't take the place. And specifically sports such as football, the High School Football Coaches Association in the state of Wisconsin has been the probably most proactive group in the country in terms of making sure their coaches are aware, hey, if you think a kid's got a concussion or if the athletic trainer says they got a concussion, they're out. There's no return until we get that kid straightened out.
Is the presence of an athletic trainer a fairly recent development? Maybe I'm showing my age here, but when I played football in high school, we didn't have a trainer anywhere near. The coaches did all the taping and all the physical therapy that was done. We didn't have one. Is this a recent development?
Well, I would say in the last 30 years, the model really developed here in the University of Wisconsin setting, where the University of Wisconsin medical group provided athletic trainers locally to schools, started in the mid-80s. And so, and that's been proliferating, and now I'd say statewide, it's probably in the last 20 years, chances are you've had access to an athletic trainer one way or another at your school.
Tim McGuine stays with us as we continue our discussion about the availability of athletic trainers at Wisconsin's high schools for the high school sports programs and what that means for the student athletes. Tim is a senior scientist and a sports medicine researcher at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Want to know what you're thinking about this. Are you an athlete who's ever been diagnosed with a concussion? If so, did an athletic trainer help you through the process? Or maybe you are an athletic trainer. Tell us about your experiences working with student athletes, particularly if you're an athletic trainer in a rural setting. What is that like? What do you think can be done to help make our high school athletes safer? And what questions do you have about identifying concussions? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. When a high school student athlete takes a hard hit, an athletic trainer may be the first on the scene to assist and diagnose any issues or injuries. But depending on the school, access to trainers can be uneven. That can be problematic, according to a new study, especially if an athlete has taken a hard hit to the head. Our guest researcher looks at the relationship between access to athletic trainers at Wisconsin high schools and how concussions are diagnosed. Are you an athlete who's been diagnosed with a concussion? If so, did an athletic trainer help you through the process? Or maybe you're an athletic trainer. Tell us about your experiences working with student athletes. What questions do you have about identifying concussions, and what do you think we can do to make our high school athletes safer? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. You can send an email to ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tim McGuine is with us. He is a senior scientist and sports medicine researcher at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Tim, is the takeaway here that schools need to devote more resources to athletic trainers?
We would love if that was the case. It'd be simple to just, you know, mandate something and, hey, make it all available. But the problem comes with money. And, again, if we have a medical provider helping to fund this, what we're doing to help them support them, it's not as simple as saying that. And I talked to some legislators a couple of years ago. I said the worst thing you can do is just pass a mandate that this needs to be done without providing funding and other accessibility issues.
Yeah, school districts don't like unfunded mandates. That much we know. But what about also the supply of athletic trainers, particularly, as you mentioned, in our inner city and our rural schools in Wisconsin? What are some solutions that we could look at there?
Well, we know there are a number. There are over 400 athletic trainers in the state of Wisconsin. So the athletic trainers are there. It's just a matter of matching them up with the employment setting. And I got to, you know, chide some of the medical providers. You know, you need to make it a worthwhile opportunity. There's a situation here 30 minutes from where I'm sitting now where the hospital wanted an athletic trainer at the school, but they wanted to pay them approximately $12,800 a year to do that. Well, in that case, you're not going to get an athletic trainer to do that. So it's got to be a dual recognition from the medical providers and the schools that it's a valued medical provider and that needs to be provided in an adequate funded setting. As I tell people, in many of these settings, the licensed athletic trainer will be the only licensed medical provider these kids have access to on a day-to-day basis. It's not a physician. It's not a physical therapist. It's not a school nurse. It's the athletic trainer. And anything we can do to increase their availability is something we got to look at, because I tell people it's not a sport issue when they think, well, you're just about sports and getting kids back to play. No. It's a public health issue. We know that injuries, concussions, ankle sprains, shoulder dislocations can have lifelong impacts, and dealing with them now and keeping kids active is such an important way to do it. It's a public health issue. It's not a sport issue.
What about if having an athletic trainer just isn't an option for schools? What else can they do to protect the health of their student athletes?
Well, that's a tough goal. We know that schools are all, you know, the schools that we're working with, they really do a pretty good job of making sure their coaches are certified in first aid. Many have coaching certifications, know how to use AEDs, CPR, et cetera. And we find that that's the case. And it's interesting because we keep talking about interscholastic settings. We have all these rules and guidelines the WIA has put in place for the interscholastic settings, but it's interesting that we see in Wisconsin there's a growing phenomenon of kids playing club sports. So volleyball, soccer, basketball play many, or if not most, of their competitions outside the school in a club setting. And a lot of these rules and mandates and coaching, I guess, insurance policies that they're going to be trained and able to medically deal with this, they're not in place in those settings. That the interscholastic settings are really the best opportunity in terms of safety and well-being for the kids than that are the mandates are in place for those coaches.
Yeah, a lot of hockey programs like that, too, in Wisconsin and in other states. But we're talking about, you mentioned rules and regulations and things like that. Are there standards for athletic trainers, and are they the same all over the place when it comes to diagnosing concussions, for example?
Well, again, we have, as I mentioned, we have to pass a certification exam and state licensure. So those guidelines are universal, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country in terms of to be certified, to be licensed, you got to go ahead and do that. So we see that uniformity there. And again, with continuing education requirements, et cetera, the athletic trainers are required to get updated on the most advanced techniques and effective techniques to go ahead and do this. So we hope everybody's able to provide the best care possible and utilize the same standards. That's one of the things we continually do.
And where do are there a number of programs at Wisconsin's universities to supply athletic trainers? I mean, is this a major program at a lot of schools? How many opportunities are there here?
Well, yeah, and the athletic training curriculum has transitioned from a bachelor's only to a master's, so you have several universities in the University of Wisconsin system that are creating and training these athletic trainers. So I tell people we have actually more athletic trainers trained in the state of Wisconsin than job opportunities right now in most settings.
So we don't have a shortage of trainers. We just aren't able to place them where we need them.
That's a good summation.
We often associate concussions with football, and well, the high school football season is over. Athletes are now playing basketball, hockey, indoor soccer. There's wrestling is going on now. I'm not sure what the seasons are anymore. But do athletes playing these sports still need to be diligent about recognizing and trying to prevent concussions, right?
Oh, exactly. I think one of the other misconceptions we have is concussions are a football issue, and they aren't. They're a sport issue, and so we have concussions occurring in every sport. And I think the statistics I tell people, and as a percentage of kids participating, you know, girls soccer is right up there with high school football. And so I said, if you want to be concerned about high school football, what we need to do to prevent concussions, we also need to look at girls soccer. We just completed the largest concussion prevention trial in the world dealing with soccer players. And it was amazing to find that the number of female soccer players reporting multiple concussions is identical in the state of Wisconsin to football players.
Let's say a student athlete isn't immediately able to see a trainer after sustaining a hard hit to the head in a game. What's your best advice for parents in this situation?
Well, again, you know, and again, most schools have information sheets available. They can get online. The parents have to sign off and view a concussion recognition and identification video or educational materials before the season, so they probably have that at their school already. If they see those symptoms, if they see those other things develop, then get them to their physician. Go ahead and go ahead and do that. Like I tell people, concussions are like most sport injuries. They're not an emergency situation. Most of the time, rarely do I send kids to the emergency room. And going to your primary care provider is probably the best way to go. And from a cost-saving aspect, that's incredible, too. So we know, like in our situation, the athletic trainers manage 30 to 40% of these concussions completely at the school, and that's a significant cost savings. In 2016-17, the average cost for getting an concussion managed at a physician is about $700. In an emergency room, it's over $4,000. So I tell parents, you know, get your primary care provider, work with them. They know your kid. They know the medical history. They're probably maybe your best opportunity to go ahead and look at that.
What kind of research needs to still be done, and what kind of research will you be doing on this subject?
Well, we're still looking at the outcomes of this. So one of the things we're also hearing that all these deleterious effects happened with concussions in terms of impacting quality of life, depression, and things. So in the same cohort of over 2,000 kids, we're monitoring, we're looking at the kids with previous concussions and how they're affected, and we're not seeing a lot of effects. And more importantly, the kids with concussions, we've followed them all for a year now, and looked at how it's impacting their symptoms, their quality of life, their depression levels, to go ahead and do that. I think we need to do a better job longitudinally with a lot of these things to go ahead and look at the – we're able to get a lot of good information. We'd always like more. I'd love to get a cohort of kids, 10,000 kids in fourth grade, and follow them throughout their high school career and early adulthood. I think that'd be the best way to go if we can go ahead and get funding for that type of thing.
Well, when it comes to research, there's always another question to ask. Tim, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tim McGuine is a senior scientist and a sports medicine researcher at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Stick around. We are going to have a lot of fun next hour with a new book called P is for Pterodactyl, and also hearing about your favorite children's stories. This ought to be really, really fun. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.